Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer, and as you've probably heard by now, Lou Reed died yesterday at 71. His passing was front page news in today's New York Times because Lou Reed was much more than a musician. As a singer and songwriter, he was a game changer. And for many listeners around the world, he was the personification of New York City. Rough-edged, hard-eyed, cool, probably dangerous. In the 60s, he co-founded the hugely influential band, The Velvet Underground.
Despite all the amputations, you know you could just go out and dance to the rock and roll station. It was all right.
It's all right.
Hey, baby, you know, it was all right.
It's all right.
After setting out on a solo career in 1970, Lou Reed produced albums that could be inspiring or infuriating or both. I mentioned in my blog post yesterday that as a Lou Reed fan, you had to constantly reconsider your fandom. You can read the whole post on our website, soundcheck.org. But with all the twists and turns in his career, his influence only seemed to grow stronger with each passing decade. For example, Kevin Barnes, who leads the band Of Montreal, has a Lou Reed moment or two that he's going to share with us later when Of Montreal comes in to perform live in our studio. But we want to hear as well from you about your Lou Reed moment, what he meant to you, a favorite song, a time you saw him in concert. And we'll start by welcoming back to Soundcheck our old friend Anthony DeCurtis, contributing editor to Rolling Stone. Hi, Anthony.
Hi, John. Good to be back.
What was, I mean, your his Lou Reed's relationship with journalists could be kind of fraught. How was it for you?
Well, I have to say, I mean, in all modesty, the last time I saw Lou, he said these very words to me. We were at a dinner. I teach at the University of Pennsylvania. I had him down there to do an interview with him in front of a group of invited guests. And it was quite a night. And then Lou agreed to have dinner with some faculty and students, which also was extraordinary. But at one point he just said to me, he goes, you know, people are always saying to me, you know, you don't get along with critics. You know, I was just in Europe and everybody's saying that to me. He goes, you know, I get along with Anthony DeCurtis. That shuts them right up. Now, why that would shut them right up, I have no idea. But he did say those words to me.
Nice. So, I mean, your reaction upon hearing the news yesterday that he had passed away, I mean, to try and encapsulate what he meant to the music world is a difficult thing to do.
Well, it's interesting. You know, I you know, this sounds kind of overstated, but I do believe that this is true, that other than Dylan and Lennon and McCartney, there is no more important figure in rock music than Lou Reed. I think that he essentially invented underground rock and alternative rock and the entire tradition, you know, with Iggy Pop and David Bowie right up till now with The National and Arcade Fire and Grizzly Bear, you know, and every stop in between. You know, Lou Reed put his stamp on that and on those artists and on those people. And that, you know, that Brian Eno line that everybody tosses around, 30,000 people bought the first Velvet Underground record, but all of those people formed a band, every single one of them. And that was true.
Mm-hmm. So the Velvet Underground, I mean, it wasn't just a band. It was part of a bigger kind of downtown New York circus.
Yes, part of the exploding plastic inevitable. I mean,
this is Andy Warhol.
Yes, exactly. This Andy Warhol kind of performance, to say piece would be to, but these performance events, I suppose, kind of performance art, you know, at which the Velvet Underground were kind of the centerpiece, you know, in which, you know, someone like Gerard Malango would get up there with leather pants and a whip, and there would be, you know, images brought, you know, film images on the walls, and there would be a light show, and there would be obviously a band playing, and all of that together, you know, connected these kind of elements of, you know, the New York underground and kind of distilled it into a sound, you know, so that when the first time you heard, you know, I'm waiting for the man or something. I mean, it sounded like the six train, like rumbling along the tracks, you know. It had that New York feel.
And it was a side of New York that people were not writing about.
Not writing about in rock and roll, certainly.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the points that Lou Reed always made, he goes, look, you know, if I were writing novels, if I were Nelson Algren or William Burroughs, if I were Martin Scorsese, you know, nobody would bat an eye at this stuff. He goes, but I'm trying to get it into rock and roll songs, and that's what gets under people's skin.
And the song you mentioned, I'm Waiting for the Man, I mean, you just listen to the lyrics. It's a drug buy going down.
$26 in my hand. Up to Lexington, 125. Sick and dirty, more dead than alive. I'm waiting for my man. Hey, white boy, what you doing uptown? Hey, white boy, you chasing all women around. Pardon me, sir, it's furthest from my mind. I'm just looking forward to a dear friend of mine. I'm waiting for my man.
I'm waiting for the man. An early kind of proto-indie rock or underground rock song.
Yeah, absolutely.
From Lou Reed and the Velvet Underground.
Both sonically and in terms of its you know, subject matter, as you mentioned, you know, a kind of drug buy up in Harlem. You know, again.
And it's so specific.
Oh,
Lexington
absolutely.
And 125.
Oh, and that is the great thing about it. I mean, it, you know, and why he's so much beloved by New Yorkers. You know, it's just like, well, you don't know where that is. That's okay. Figure it out. You know, it's just
We're speaking with Anthony DeCurtis, contributing editor of Rolling Stone, about the late Lou Reed. Now, you mentioned that, you know, his influence continues to be felt today. It was felt almost immediately through people like David Bowie, who in the early 70s started singing I'm Waiting for the Man in his concerts.
Right.
And then, of course.
Well, you know, I mean, right up the line, you know, a little bit later. I mean, Iggy Pop, of course.
Mm-hmm.
A little bit further on down the line, you know, Patti Smith and Talking Heads and Television. You know, after that, mm-hmm. post-punk, you get, you know, R.E.M. and U2.
And there's also the moment where Bowie and Reed come together in what was a kind of transformative moment.
Oh, well, that
in
album
Reed's
Transformer,
career.
Of course. I mean, included, you know, Lou's great hit, you know, Walk on the Wild Side, but also just a great kind of, it was like Lou's take on glam rock and his, you know, kind of Americanization of glam rock. And at the same time, you know, it was a record that made a tremendous impact and took for granted, you know, this kind of demimonde of, you know, sexual adventurism and drug use that, you know, now, I mean, again, is something that, you know, is kind of well-worn, but at the time was kind of really eye-opening.
Mm-hmm. And there are kind of flashes of humor on that record,
absolutely.
Too. A New York telephone conversation, for example. And also kind of elements of, there's like a romantic element to it too.
Deeply romantic. And I think this is the kind of element of Lou Reed that often gets overlooked.
Absolutely.
You know, there is a kind of a yearning for what you might call almost kind of traditional love and connection, mm-hmm. I think, that runs through his work. There's a tremendous empathy with these characters, although it's completely unsentimental with the you know, inhabitants of the demimonde. But on the other hand, Lou always had his eye, you know, that I want to play football for the coach and this idea on what another life might have been.
Well, you're quoting from the song Coney Island Baby.
Yes.
Where, you know, that line repeats, I just want to play football for the coach. And
right.
I know a lot of people were sort of taken aback by that because this is the guy who writes about, you know, S&M and heroin addiction. What's he writing about wanting to get a letter on your varsity, you know, on your jersey for, on your jacket?
Well, you know, I do really do believe, you know, there's a great moment at the beginning of that album, 1969, which was a, you know, a tape of the Velvet Underground playing down in Texas. And there, it opens with a long kind of monologue by Lou talking to them about watching the Dallas Cowboys on TV that day. And he says to the audience, you know, because I saw the Cowboys, you know, they're playing the 49ers today, and they just, you know, it was just not, it was a joke. They just, you know, ran away with the game and won it by, you know, however many touchdowns. And he goes, you know, you got to give people a little bit of a chance in football anyway. And, you know, that sense of, you know, Lou Reed, you know, I mean, I think people's notions about, like, Lou Reed in Dallas on a Sunday afternoon is going to be, like, wandering around, like, looking for the nearest drug dealer. But, in fact, he was watching the Dallas Cowboys and pondering the meaning of their, you know, runaway upset victory.
So this, too, was part of Lou Reed, as we hear in the song Coney Island Baby.
You know, man, when I was a young man in high school, believe it or not, I wanted to play football for the coach. And all those older guys, they said that he was mean and cruel, but you know, I want to play football for the coach. They said I was a little too lightweight to play linebacker, so that I'm playing right end. I want to play football for the coach. Cause you know someday, man, you gotta stand up straight, unless you're gonna fall. Then you're going to die. And the straightest dude I ever knew was standing right by me all the time. So I had to play football for the coach. Man, I wanted to play football.
That is Lou Reed with the title track from the album Coney Island Baby. We're remembering a complicated guy.
Without question.
On Soundcheck today. Anthony DeCurtis with me, contributing editor at Rolling Stone. Listeners, we want to hear about your Lou Reed memory, your Lou Reed moment, the impact his music had on you, seeing him in concert, maybe a run-in with the man himself. You can call us at 866-939-1612. Or leave a comment on our website, soundcheck.org. The number again, toll-free, 866-939-1612. Tim from Sedona posted this. I saw Lou Reed at the Bottom Line in the Village. I guess it was mid-80s. This was a scene I was not going to forget, and of course, the place was packed, which it always would be when Lou Reed performed, but, you know, there were definite peaks and valleys.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. I mean, look, and this is something also, another thing I think that, you know, people don't get when you're living, you know, you don't get to really alter the course of music more than once or twice in your career. And, you know, and if you do it once, that immediately puts you in the pantheon of people. If you're living contemporaneously with an artist, you know, there's going to be some down moments. And especially someone like Lou Reed, who is not really censoring himself. I mean, every time out, you know, he was trying to do whatever it was he felt at that moment. Sometimes it worked, sometimes it didn't. But, you know, it certainly worked enough time. I mean, even during that long solo career, man, there are 6 or 8 records, it seems to me, that, you know, are extremely significant.
Mm-hmm. Was he, in your experience, much of a tech geek? I mean, he seemed
completely.
To...
I mean, that was the
thing. That seems to be another surprising answer.
Well, yeah, well, I know, because he's revered for the kind of quote-unquote rawness of those early records, which he would complain about endlessly. I mean, he felt like, you know, because of what the band was doing, you know, the engineers wouldn't really give him proper attention. And the band, you know, they were novices and they didn't know how to do it themselves. So, you know, he heard those records in a very different way from everybody else who loved them. And he used to say to me all the time, I mean, I'm, you know, helpless technically. And, you know, I was using, you know, cassette tapes until, you know, not that long ago. And Lou would sit, every time I sat down to interview him, he goes, you know, because you're never going to give that up. Here, you know, like, call this guy, you know, he'll get you this machine. And, you know, we went through the whole thing. He'll get you a DAT machine. He'll get you a digital recorder, you know, whatever it was.
Do you remember his book of photography?
Of course.
From 2006?
Absolutely.
So Lou came on Soundcheck and he was shooting with a digital camera back then. And I noted during the course of our interview that, you know, he had lived through that transition from the analog to the digital age in both music and photography.
big advantage for me.
Mm-hmm.
I had a major league advantage because this already went down in music. You see what's happened. We're at the beginning of the... This is like the invention of the airplane or something. It's that big a thing. We're at the very beginning of the biggest change ever. It's mm-hmm. really fantastic. And mourning the loss of film or tape is not the point of all this. They're two different things. However, the digital makes it possible for everybody, anywhere, to go right out and make some music
mm-hmm.
or take a picture.
And that's another part of his legacy, isn't it? That DIY is that idea that yeah. anyone can do it.
Sure, because if you hear, I mean, you know, as you know, every single person playing on that, you know, I'm Waiting for the Man, you know, is like an amazing musician, you know. I mean, obviously John Cale and Sterling Morrison, certainly, and even in her own way, Maureen Tucker. At the same time, you know, it sounds so raw, and it does sound like the kind of thing like, God, if I just got together with my friends, we could play that, you know,
right.
And that was huge. I mean, that was really, really important.
Now, are there underappreciated albums in his career that you think people should be revisiting?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. You know, there's New Sensations, for example, from the 80s is a record that, you know, doesn't really get the attention that I think it deserves. And from the very end, I mean, I think it might be the last studio album he made, called Ecstasy.
Mm-hmm.
I think is a really, really powerful record. And I have no doubt that if he'd continue to record, he could still come up with a great record. You know, he had that kind of vision.
So Ecstasy was his sort of last major studio album. I mean, the Raven had lots of other people.
Yes.
Lulu had Metallica. This was a Lou Reed album.
Right. And it, you know, it was raw, and there was a kind of emotional desperation in it that about relationships in particular that really made me wonder, like, what was going on with him and Laurie Anderson, or if it was really autobiographical. I mean, it wasn't. It evidently was not. But, you know, he had that ability to just kind of really cut right into the bone. And when you listen, you know, to that music on that record, you know, you can feel that. Although the title track, Ecstasy, is actually very beautiful in its own way.
Well, let's hear a little bit of that. The title track from Lou Reed's 2000 record, Ecstasy.
Across the streets, an old Ford that took off its wheels. The engine is gone. In its seat sits a box with a note that says, "Goodbye, Charlie, thanks a lot." I see a child through a window with a bib, and I think of us and what we almost did. The Hudson rocketing with light, the ships past the Statue of Liberty at night. They call it ecstasy, 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 ecstasy. Some men call me Saint Ivory, some call me Saint Maurice. I'm smooth as alabaster, with white veins running through my cheeks. A big stud through my eyebrow.
That is Lou Reed with the title track from his 2000 album called Ecstasy, an underappreciated record, according to Anthony DeCurtis, my guest, contributing editor of Rolling Stone. I always had a soft spot in my heart for the Bells.
Oh, you know what? I did notice that in your blog, and I agree completely. That's a record that's often disparaged, and I never quite understood why. I mean, it's really daring, but on the other hand, inside all of these experiments is an incredible musicality,
yeah.
I think you would agree, and certainly on that record.
You know, listeners, we're talking about Lou Reed, who died yesterday at the age of 71. There are as many views of Lou Reed as there are listeners, I suppose. And we want to hear your Lou Reed moment, the impact he had on you, seeing him either in person or on stage. You can call us at 866-939-1612. Or leave a comment at soundcheck.org. The number again, 866-939-1612. And Matthew is joining us on the line here in New York, in fact, from Tribeca. So, Matthew, you're not just from the same city as Lou Reed, but the same general area as well, right?
Absolutely.
So did you ever see him on the street?
I used to see him on the street on several occasions. In fact, as you know, Tribeca is sort of littered with celebrities from the music and film world.
Right.
And so I sort of have my pick of celebrities that I would, you know, semi-stalk down the block. Lou was high among them.
Uh-huh.
And there's only a couple of others that sort of rate my personal stalking behavior.
I'll take the semi part of the stalking behavior seriously there, Matthew. So do you have a Lou Reed memory or moment for us?
Yeah, I do. And it's not from recent times. It's actually from actually when the Velvet Underground first happened and that whole Andy Warhol scene was percolating and then exploding here in New York. That particular era and epoch was of my older sister's generation.
Mm-hmm.
And so she had the great fortune to, you know, probably pass through the factory at one point or another. And I unfortunately was too young to experience that specific scene and the clubs of the day, like the Cheetah and the Dave Paul scene and the Electric Circus. I hit the next generation, so New Wave and CBGBs and Mud Club and mm-hmm. Area a little later on. And
by which point, Lou Reed was sort of, an Eminence Grease.
Yes,
kind
exactly.
Of.
Absolutely. And didn't he take the 80s off?
No.
New York came out in the 80s.
Yeah,
I mean, that
yeah,
was
yeah.
A great record.
There were a couple of things in the 80s, he was definitely sort of changing.
I think
changing.
The Bells came out in the 80s, too.
Or it was right around the 79, 80, time. Yeah. Matthew, thanks very much for the call. Again, we're remembering Lou Reed, who passed away yesterday at the age of 71. We've got Anthony DeCurtis with us here in the studio, contributing editor to Rolling Stone, and your calls and comments at 866-939-1612. We'll continue in just a moment, and live music from the Band of Montreal coming up later on Soundcheck. Tonight, make sure to visit our website, soundcheck.org, at 10 p.m. Eastern to listen to Arcade Fire live in concert. The band will be playing songs from their new album, Reflector, from Capitol Studios in Los Angeles. That's Arcade Fire tonight, 10 p.m. Eastern, live on soundcheck.org from L.A. Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Lou Reed's Perfect Day is from that Watershed album called Transformer that David Bowie and his guitarist Mick Ronson produced for Lou Reed back in the early 70s. Anthony DeCurtis, contributing editor of Rolling Stone, here with me as we're remembering Lou Reed, who passed away yesterday at the age of 71. It's funny how this song, Perfect Day, now has like a second or even third life in pop culture.
No, and it's, obviously with his death, it's something that's been referred to a million times. And, of course, you know, Transformer and the album that, Transformer was a big hit. The other hand, you know, the album that came after it, Berlin, you know, was just vilified at mm-hmm. the time. And, of mm-hmm. course, you know, that's a kind of accrued significance, over time. And, you know, I was just listening to that part from Perfect Day, you know, with its allusion to the Supremes. I mean, Lou, of course, loved Motown with that "You Keep Me Hanging On" idea, you know, and worked into a song that's, you know, really a kind of cry of desperation. You know, it's amazing stuff.
And, you know, a song that I think probably took aback people who were used to songs like Vicious or,
yes,
you know, Rock and Roll or Heroin, where it's, I mean, I remember thinking, this sounds like something my parents would listen to. Why do I like this? And yet I did.
Right.
I couldn't quite figure that out.
I think that's another part of that kind of yearning in his music, you know, that there was a great kind of you know, romantic yearning.
Mm.
And the same way that there always was a musicality, I think within the darkest and even most cynical and grating and scarifying stuff, there still was that element of emotionality and romance.
Yeah. Let's take a call. Carlos is on the line with us from Long Island City. Hi, Carlos.
Hey, how are you?
Okay. You got a Lou Reed memory for us?
Not so much a memory, but just an encapsulation of time. And in New York, I moved into the East Village in 88, in my early 20s. And when New York came out the following year in 89, that whole album just seemed to perfectly preserve and amber what New York City was going through with the crack epidemic and the AIDS epidemic.
Exactly.
And stepping over homeless people every day on my way to work in Soho. And each one of those songs was just another part of my daily life. And Lou was able to put in his lyrics, you know, the disgust and the love and the excitement of being in New York City at that time. And I spent a good part of the days re-listening to that album, and it just kind of really makes you remember.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was, I mean, I think that's an amazing record, and precisely for the reason that Carlos identified. You know, at that point, you know, there were 2,000 murders a year in this city. I remember, like, somebody getting killed in a Gap store in the middle of the afternoon on a weekday. You know, and I just thought, man, if you can't secure, like, West 57th Street on a Wednesday afternoon, like, this city is just out of control, you know?
And yet, at that point, Lou Reed had sort of gotten his life under control.
That's true. And I think, that New Sensations album that came out, I think, in 84, I think marked that point, you know? The title track talks about a desire to really, you know, he goes, a year ago today, I was arrested on Christmas Eve. And, like, there was a sense in that song, like, that's never going to happen again. That's not going to be my life. I'm not going out like that. And at the same time, there was a kind of aesthetic statement on the record, you know, doing the things that we want to, where he talks about Sam Shepard, and he talks about Martin Scorsese, and he talks about, you know, this is the work we want to do. This is the stuff that we care about. And it's so powerful and affecting.
This is the song, Doing the Things That We Want To, from that album, The New Sensations by Lou Reed.
There's not much you hear on the radio today, hey.
Doing the things that you want to.
But you could still see a movie or a play.
Doing the things that you want to.
Here's to Travis Bickle and here's to Johnny Bull. Song, 'cause I'd like to shake your hand.
You
in a way, you guys, the best friends I ever had.
Doing the things that we want to.
Doing the things that we want to. That we want to. A true love.
Lou Reed, Doing the Things That We Want To, from his 1984 album, New Sensations. Connie from Jackson Heights writes that she saw him a couple of times in concert. She writes, very sad, very brave, uncompromising, launched 1,000 groups, all of which not even open to debate. That's
exactly.
All absolutely true.
Perfectly
he was
true.
Uncompromising. He could be very prickly. Anthony, did you ever get on his bad side?
When I invited him down to Penn, this is the only time he was going to come down and do this thing. It's an evening that we have at the Kelly Writers House at Penn. And the day before he was supposed to come, it involves going to a reception and then
you know, doing an interview with me for an hour and then having dinner with like faculty and students, you know. But he agreed to it, you know. And then at the last minute, it was just, well, I don't really want to do the reception and I don't really want to do the dinner. And I just like, Lou, look, you know, it's like the 11th hour here. You can't do this. And he just said, well, we could just blow off the whole thing together, right? We could just blow it off. And it's like, man, I was at the last moment. But of course he came down, and it was an amazing experience for everybody who was there. He totally showed up. And his one demand, I mean, this is the thing, like, what is Lou Reed going to ask for? He asked for kielbasa. I am not joking. Which we got him from De Bruno's down in Philadelphia, and he was literally ecstatic.
He was full of surprises. Back in 2006, he was on soundcheck to talk about his photography book called Lou Reed's New York. And this was, you remember our old studios, our old WNYC studios. They were located in a city-operated building with tight security. Listen to me desperately trying to wrap up our interview that day.
It's called Lou Reed's New York, which
but
is
if it had to go through the security you guys have downstairs, I'm amazed it even got upstairs.
We are important people here.
Yeah. They're so sweet downstairs. You know, I came in with a little dog, and they said, do you have the papers for this dog? I said, she's a very important dog, but I actually didn't bring her passport and papers with her.
I said,
okay, guy, out. That's it.
So the dog is waiting for you elsewhere, then?
The dog is elsewhere being photographed to get a dog passport to get into your building.
Sensational.
He was not happy that he couldn't get his little dog.
So great that he could not let it go, either. Yeah, that was not a great trait, letting it go.
Nope. And thank goodness for that, because he never let go of so many things that made him so important to so many people. Anthony DeCurtis, contributing editor to Rolling Stone, remembering Lou Reed, who died yesterday at the age of 71. Anthony, great to see you again.
Oh, well, thank you so much.
You hit me with a flower. You do it every hour. Oh, baby, you're so vicious.
Coming up next, live music in our studio from the Band of Montreal. Their new album is called Lousy with Sylvian Brier. What, you say? Well, we'll find out more, and we'll hear some live music next on Soundcheck.
Baby, you're so vicious. When I watch you come, baby, I just want to run far away. You're not the kind of person I want to stay. My baby's meditating to stop the war.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. The indie pop band called Of Montreal has spent 15 years or so weaving together strands of psychedelia, funk, electronic music. The Athens, Georgia group has a new album called Lousy with Sylvian Brier. And there's another influence to be felt here, the twangy flower power rock of the late 60s and early 70s. They're about to play some of it live for us here in the Soundcheck studio. Here's Of Montreal with Fugitive Air.
Son swings a living rabbit by the leg while his mother's playing to wooden flutes. I went to repo some fugitive AF to escape the street's vagaries. Aesthetic. Has anybody here seen my old friend Blobbo? Has anybody seen where he's gone? What he thinks I owe him is his former life, but how can I unmake someone else's mistakes? I guess I was his anti-hero, the bitter word on his lips. I hope I never feel a terror like when you discovered your autonomy had flipped. I feel like I possess only the bad aspects of invisibility, but none of the good ones. I will walk in mausoleums of scented rotting flesh. Mother always liked you best, lacked your teeth upon her breast. They removed the oils from the eyes of street cats through some shitty witchcraft and applied it to their brows and genitalia. I had no idea how deeply I wounded you, but I don't need no forgiveness, and no level of contrition would ever do. La la la, la la.
Band is called Of Montreal, although they're from Athens, GA, and they're here in our New York studio on Soundcheck today, performing some new songs from their album Lousy with Sylvian Breyer. That one's called Fugitive Air. Kevin Barnes is the band's guitarist and singer and songwriter. Kevin, good to see you again.
Yeah, good to see you too.
Rebecca Cash doing some vocals, Clayton Ricklick behind the drums doing more vocals, Bennett Lewis on electric guitar, Bob Parrins playing the bass, JoJo Glidewell is at our piano. And Kevin, you heard earlier in the show we were talking with Anthony DeCurtis about the late Lou Reed. And I mean, I remember the last time you were on Soundcheck, you guys were warming up before the show with some early Bowie. So Lou Reed seems like it would pretty much be in your wheelhouse too.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, he was one of the first writers that I really connected with and was inspired by, you know, as far as, you know, here's somebody that's writing about unconventional things, real things, raw things, you know, and doing it in a really interesting and poetic way. And yeah, so, you know, when you're, it's this great alternative to what is sort of force-fed you, you know, through the radio or through the television or whatever, this kind of outlaw character.
Right. So do you have, like, a particular memory of, you know, a moment when something of his just kind of, like, blew the top of your head off or whatever?
Well, I think that, you know, when I first discovered him in high school, it was the same thing as, you know, discovering Kerouac or Salinger or whatever, you know, it's those defining moments that really open up your mind, you know, so you realize, like, okay, so, you know, the world that my parents live in or their friends live in or whatever, it seems so boring to me, but here's this other option or whatever, you know, there's this other way of thinking. And even if your world, you know, if you live in suburbia or whatever, which I did, you know, it's like extremely boring and there's not much happening, but to discover, you know, people like Lou Reed or Burroughs or Kerouac, whatever, at the time, it was incredible, you know, definitely.
Where did you grow up?
In Michigan, mm-hmm. the suburb of Detroit.
Because, you know, for all that Lou Reed was born in New York and, you know, was like an iconic New Yorker, he spent some of his formative years out on Long Island in the New York suburbs, and he always said he hated it. Yeah. You know, that's what scared... New York never scared me, he said. You know,
yeah.
Long Island, that scares me. So, now, you guys, last night, in the first of two nights at the Music Hall of Williamsburg, you played a Lou Reed song.
Mm-hmm.
Which one was it?
Waiting for the Man.
Mm-hmm. So is that just something you had in your fingertips? As a songwriter, you're just able to kind of call up a Lou Reed song when you need it?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think that I just felt, you know, pretty devastated by the loss. But, you know, in a way, it's not really... I didn't know him personally, you know. So mm-hmm. it's really just kind of like, you know, Clayton and I were talking about that, like how when an artist dies, all of a sudden you just sort of like realize how special they were,
yeah.
you know, because you kind of just take them for granted while they're still living. But yeah, so that song, something that I've always loved, that first record is obviously incredible, and that song has right. an incredible presence to it. So
we're speaking with Kevin Barnes of the band Of Montreal. I had written on our website in a blog post yesterday how, you know, Lou Reed didn't make it easy on his fans because he was constantly, you know, challenging them with new and different things. You don't necessarily make things easy on your fans either. I mean, you do a lot of, especially with the language that you use. You know, people who want to kind of get into the lyrics and try and figure out what you're talking about will often find themselves in a little blind switch somewhere, you know, a little verbal cul-de-sac.
Yeah, but I mean, I think it's just the nature of rock and roll lyrics. People just expect them a lot of times to be really conventional and simplistic, but... I read a lot of poetry, and, you know, poetry is always very obtuse and challenging. So
so when you're writing, do you write poetry as well as song lyrics?
I do, yeah. I mean, it's basically just lyrics that I haven't used. Uh-huh. I don't really think of myself on that level of being a poet or whatever. It's just kind of, I think of myself more as a songwriter.
Mm-hmm.
But I do write all the time.
Well, and a lot of your titles, it's almost as if there's a kind of poetry built into the phrases, but into single words. For example, Sylvian Briar,
mm-hmm.
the new album, Lousy with Sylvian Briar. What is Sylvian Briar?
Well, I felt like Sylvia Plath sort of haunted the creation of the record, and not in a negative way, in a, you know, positive way.
Yeah.
And so I wanted the album to have a reference to her. So Sylvian Briar is just a word that I made up, but it's this image in my head, if something was lousy with Sylvian Briar, it'd actually be a really good thing.
Mm-hmm. So, as you say, the kind of the ghost, the shade of Sylvia Plath is hovering over this record, which people who know her story, you know, an early suicide, a troubled marriage before that, might think would, you know, make for a dark record.
Yeah.
What was your intention with the sort of the color of this record?
Well, it's kind of all over the place. You know, there's a lot of obvious references, you know, musical reference points of, you know, Dylan and you know, early 70s Grateful Dead and things like that, Leonard Cohen.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of very introspective lyrics. It's a very personal record, very confessional, and, you know, it's just straight out of my personal life.
Mm-hmm. Although, again, if people are looking for first this happened and then that happened,
yeah.
Not necessarily what you're talking about here.
No, it's not really. It's just kind of like, I mean, I think all the records, at least the last, you know, pretty much all the records have been basically like an open diary, you know, this period of time that I was working on the record and writing the songs and recording the songs and, you know, all the things that I was thinking about and all the relationships that I was having and, you know, films that I've been watching or whatever. It all just kind of gets thrown into it.
The results is the new album from Of Montreal called Lousy with Sylvian Briar. It is out now, and the band is here in our soundcheck studio playing a couple of songs from it for us. You want to do Colossus next?
Yeah.
All right. Once again, Of Montreal, live on soundcheck.
Mother hung herself in the National Theater when she was 4 months pregnant with your sister. Who would have
been 13 years old today. Does that make you feel any less alone in the world? Your dad, I'm sure he tried his best. He thought you'd be better off living with your grandmother. He didn't realize that she'd already given up. Baby, your family, they're all such losers. I've become such a wolf around you. My thoughts go dark and all out of focus. Have no peace in my mind. Owls are going insane outside my house. It is a season of trouble and self-destruction. All of my friends, they are falling apart, but not me, I'm in control. Remember the exquisite corpse that we created together. We laughed at the time, it seems so such a wolf around you. My thoughts go dark and all out of focus. I have no peace in my mind because you've touched me.
Song called Colossus by the Band of Montreal, playing live here in the Soundcheck studio, here in our New York studio, playing tonight at the Music Hall of Williamsburg in Brooklyn. The new album's called Lousy with Sylvian Breyer. It is out now, the latest from Of Montreal. And let's hear another song. This one's called Raindrop in My Skull.
There's a raindrop in my skull. I'm too shaky now to get it out. I guess it fell from some faraway cloud, bloated with radiation. Ooh, some people are singing of the birth of another soulless drone who grow to leech off the earth. Ooh. My guitar feels strange in my hands. I have almost no tactile perceptions. On the TV there's a Mexican horror film. It isn't dubbed.
Raindrop in My Skull, the name of that song from the Band of Montreal. Their new album is called Lousy with Sylvian Breyer, and they've been playing some of it for us here in the Soundcheck studio. Kevin Barnes singing and playing guitar. Rebecca Cash took lead vocals on that last song. Jojo Glidewell at our piano. Clayton Ricklick playing the drums. Bennett Lewis on guitar. And Bob Parrins playing the bass. The band is playing tonight at the Music Hall of Williamsburg and playing for us today in the Soundcheck studio. So, Kevin, you mentioned before bands like The Grateful Dead, you know, that kind of San Francisco scene from 40 years ago. Is that a new kind of element, or has that been in this band all along?
I've always loved 60s music. For whatever reason, 60s and 70s music has always been my favorite. I'm always discovering new bands from that time period, or old bands from that time period, new to me. And I think I just like the way people went about their business in that time period, mm-hmm. you know, and can, for whatever reason, just identify with it more.
So you actually went to San Francisco for a while you were gestating this record.
Yeah, for some reason I had this thought that I should go to San Francisco and work on the record, and so rented this apartment in the Mission District, and was living out there for about 3.5 weeks, mm-hmm. and didn't really know that many people, so I was just sort of wandering around and people watching and reading and just basically getting out of, you know, my comfort zone and getting away from all my, you know, entanglements and
the usual haunts and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So, and did it work? I mean, did you get something different than you would have gotten had you stayed back home?
I think so, yeah. I mean, the San Francisco of 2013 is obviously nothing like, you know, what I imagined the San Francisco of 1967 to be.
Right.
But it still has, you know, it has this great, character, this great personality to it, and great diversity, you know, so like all the different neighborhoods. You know, so I walked to the Castro District, you know, which is obviously, you know, like the big gay district, and, you know, the Mission has a huge Hispanic population, and, you know, just everywhere you go, it's such a melting pot.
I haven't been in San Francisco in a while, but the Mission District used to have, like, performance venues on every block. Is it still like that?
Yeah, there's a ton of bars and a ton of clubs. And, yeah, and it's cool. It's just a really interesting city. I have this sort of romantic notion about it. So it was cool to be there and, you know, just be somewhere that felt really exotic and interesting.
Mm-hmm. So we hear some of the echoes of that in the new record, Lousy with Sylvian Breyer. What's happening with Song Dynasties, this proposed kind of film project, documentary of the band's performances?
It's coming together. The guy who directed it is also editing it, and so I'm kind of, my hands are out of it in that sense. He'll just send me clips, like, what do you think of this? And I'm like, oh, that's really good, change this or that or whatever. But so I'm not the one that's, like, actively putting it together.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I think it seems like it's going to happen, if not by the end of the year, at least by the beginning part of next year.
Right. And this will be, it's like all kinds of archival footage, including some stuff that you found that I guess you didn't even know existed of some of the earliest shows of the band. Is that right?
Yeah, there's a ton of footage that we took just, you know, with little handheld camcorders or whatever back in the day when we were driving ourselves around in the van and sleeping on random people's floors and things like that.
Yeah.
So that's kind of cool to go back and see that stuff. But I mean, it's kind of a funny thing when you have a document of your life or your career or whatever. It's like, it's hard for me to watch it because, you know, I would want to, like, edit, like, everything out, basically. I don't want anybody seeing any of that stuff. But it's, you know, not for me. It's for people who are interested in the band or whatever.
So Song Dynasties will be the name of that project, which we'll look for later this year, early next year. In the meantime, the album is out, called Lousy with Sylvian Breyer. The band is Of Montreal. Kevin, to you and the band, thanks so much for playing for us today.
Yeah, thank you.
This is Soundcheck.
Don't be naive, you know it's true. And if you don't protect yourself, obsidian currents, obsidian currents, what about you?
That's going to do it for Soundcheck today. Tomorrow, we kick off Soundcheck's House of Horrors, a series of ultra-terrifying shows leading up to Halloween. Tomorrow, we'll talk with our friends from the Takeaways Movie Date podcast about some of the scariest sounding movies they've ever encountered. And we'll hear from some of our recent guests about who they think is the scariest musician ever. And we want you to tell us who you think is the scariest musician of all time. You can leave us a voicemail at 866-939-1612. That's 866-939-1612. Or tweet us using the hashtag #scariestmusician. Also tomorrow, live music from the Brooklyn band Teen. Don't forget to join us online. If you're not already listening on soundcheck.org, go there now, because at 10 p.m. Eastern, we will have a live concert from Arcade Fire from Los Angeles at the Capitol Theater. That's coming up at 10 p.m. Eastern on soundcheck.org. That's going to do it for today's show. Thanks for joining us. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.